songs about that time. Right about now.
Right about now. Right about now.
In Thailand, an operation has begun to rescue the 12 boys and their football coach from the flooded cave where they've been trapped for the last fortnight.
12 boys, all members of the local Wild Boar Academy football club, ventured into the Tham Luang Nang Nong cave with their 25-year-old coach after football training.
Darkness, cold, rushing water and time. Rescuers will have to overcome all those elements to bring the boys to sunlight. And right now, it is not clear how or how quickly that can happen.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of Right About Now. I'm your host, Jonathan Small. So unless you live in a cave, you probably remember the story last summer of a Thai youth soccer team that was trapped in a flooded cave. So my guest today is Mark Aronson, whose new book, Rising Water, The Story of the Thai Cave Rescue, brings to life this crazy drama that captured the world's attention. Mark's book is written for middle graders, but as he explains, its themes of internationalism and working together to help each other will really resonate with everyone.
How we behaved collectively as the world together in Thailand was truly inspiring.
Mark is on the graduate faculty at Rutgers University School of Communication. His other award-winning books include Trapped, How the World Rescued 33 Miners, and Master of Deceit, J. Edgar Hoover, and America in the Age of Lies. So Mark Aronson, welcome to Right About Now.
Thanks for having me.
Let's dive in, no pun intended. Set the scene for us, if you will.
Very, very far north in Thailand, in an area that is sometimes called the Golden Triangle, where the tip edge of northern Thailand meets up with Burma and Laos. There are extremely porous borders there, which for a long time were used by opium smugglers, then more recently meth smugglers. But it also means that there is fluid movement of peoples illegally across the borders of these various countries, where Thailand is significantly wealthier. So in that part of the country, a kind of a wonderful man created a soccer club for teenagers, sort of kids from 12 to 18, 19, not just to improve their skills at soccer, but because given the fact that there are these movements of people in the area, and many of the people who live there actually are what's called stateless. In America, we speak about people being undocumented. But in the case in Thailand, it's even more extreme. These are people who arrive in Thailand with no papers from anywhere. So they are neither Thai, nor are they Burmese or Laotian or Cambodian or Vietnamese or Chinese. Several of the boys that I'm going to talk about in a moment come from ethnic groups who within Burma itself and within Laos itself see themselves as semi-independent and sort of do not have had many clashes with the governmental authority. So it's quite possible that if you were a member of such a group, you might not even have government papers within your home country because you really kind of see yourself as autonomous. So there are somewhere between 400,000 and some people even think 3 million stateless people in Thailand. So this wonderful man created this youth soccer team significantly for kids like that. 20 out of the 70 kids are stateless. And his assistant coach, who's known as Ek by nickname, was also stateless.
So what ended up happening to these kids?
So a group of these kids who were somewhere between the ages of 11 and one who turned 17 had a game, and after the game, just for fun, with Eck, they decided to go explore a local cave. And this is a cave that is well known. People go there, school groups go there. You know, it's not some obscure place. It is completely safe in the dry season. But the thing about this particular cave, it is one that was carved by nature out of limestone cliffs, you know, millions of years of shells that have kind of compressed together. And what that means is that though it is a rock, it is extremely porous. So when the heavy rains, the monsoon winds and rains come to Thailand, this cave turns from, you know, a challenging but dry crawl into a flooded system that is considered one of the four or five most dangerous caves in the entire world.
So they went for this cave exploration, but weren't they aware that this was like monsoon season and this might be dangerous, or at least their coach might have been aware of that?
The thing is that last year, the monsoons had not come until mid-July. So they thought, you know, it's cool. We're still in the dry season. We're just going to hop and have fun. But as they went into the cave, and the beginning of the cave is flat and even slightly paved, but as you go further and further and further, you're just climbing up and down in and out of rocks. It's whatever pathway is the pathway you take. They started to notice water. And the fact is that inside the cave, no matter what's going on outside of the cave, you can't hear it. So it's not like being out in the field where you see thunderclouds, you know, over a hill and you say, oh boy, we better get going. You're in a cave. It is pitch black, except for the flashlights that they had. So you have no sense that the weather is changing until they started to notice the water. And they decided to try to turn back and go through the water, which by now was so deep where they were that it was actually over the head of the coach when he tried to go through it.
So what did they decide to do at this point?
They made the smart move to retreat further into the cave until they found a kind of sandy landing spot that seemed to be above the water. And there they were, so now you have 12 boys between the ages of 11 and 17, and one 25-year-old coach on a sandy bank with no food, with flashlights, but since they, of course, were not sure how long they would be there, they had to be very careful because they only have as much light as their batteries will provide. And they do have water, not the rainwater that is flooded beneath them, but because the water that was coming into the cave filtered through the limestone, as it dripped down to them, it was clear. It was pure. It had been purified by it's like a natural Brita filter that they were surrounded by. So they had water, no food, only as much light as they were willing to risk, and there they were.
So, Mark, at this point, did anybody know that the kids had gone into the cave?
The man who had created the soccer team, this wonderful man, his nephew had been at the game, who was also 13, was also part of the soccer team. But his nephew had not gone on to the cave. He didn't have a bike. You had to bike to the cave. So he'd come home. So the head coach called his nephew and said, you know, where are those guys? And his nephew said, they're in the cave. So now, because everyone did know, obviously, that it was raining, they knew about the cave. So the coach raced to the cave, and people started to come to the cave because now they realized the peril. They realized where the kids were, and they realized that they were trapped. And some local sort of search and rescue folks came to try to enter the cave. And they couldn't do it. It was beyond their skills and capacity. And by midnight, they had called the governor of the province, and he came at midnight of that first night. So, you know, you immediately had this kind of high-level concern and interest. And it became clear, as the local rescuers really could not even get into the cave due to the water levels, that they needed help. And so the first big step they took was to make use of the Thai Navy SEALs. You think of American Navy SEALs, we know all about it, them from Osama bin Laden or TV shows, or, you know, there's been quite a lot of attention paid recently to SEALs. Well, the Thai SEALs have been around almost as long as the American SEALs and received the same, very similar training, even training with Americans. So these are people who are very hardy, very physical, very skilled in coping with difficult circumstances. And they are trained divers. That is to say, they know how to use scuba equipment. They know how to use gas tanks and to dive. However, and this is really crucial, they are trained to dive in open water, in lakes, in the ocean, in circumstances where their diving skills might be needed.
So this is a very different type of diving.
Cave diving is a beast of a different color. Diving through flooded caves has been called the world's most dangerous sport.
Mm-hmm.
The death toll is very high. And that is, if you think about it, if you are diving underwater, well, what do you need? You need air. So you need to be carrying whatever air you're going to breathe in whatever combination of gases is suited to however deep you're going to go. You know, we've seen divers going after wrecks or sharks. You may have watched one kind of, you know, TV show about this or another. In cave diving, not only do you have to bring your own air and know the right combination of gases, you are entering a space where you do not necessarily know what you're facing. Where will there be sharp rocks? Where will there be turns you can't get through? Where might you get stuck? So in addition to calculating literally how much air you must bring so that you will survive, you have to figure out a way to mark your journey in, which is also your journey out. And what that means is, one, they use the rule of threes. That is to say, you bring one third of the air you bring in is to get you where you're going. One third of the air you bring is to get you back. And one third is in case of an emergency. And how you track where you're going is that as the first person enters the cave, they do something called laying line, which is to say they take a big, thick rope. And depending on where they are or what kind of diver they are, they either nail it as they go along or they tie it around rock outcroppings as they go. That's the passage in. That's the passage for anyone to find you if you get stuck or lost. That's the passage out. So initially, when the Thai Navy SEALs went in there, they were organized, they were brave, they were determined, but they neither fully knew where they were going, nor did they have the specific skills needed to find the boys. And this, now I have to explain one really crucial thing. To picture this cave system, think of a giant letter, capital T. There's a entrance, big open entranceway. You go follow in straight along the entranceway, and then it splits into two different arms, like the two arms of the capital T. And all of this is at an incline. What that means is when rainwaters come down and through the limestone and fill the cave, the two streams of water meet at what was called the T-junction. And as it happens, the boys, correctly, in retreating, had retreated down one arm of the T, what might be seen as the left arm. But that meant that anyone who was trying to reach them would have to cross the T junction. And that was going to be where the water was going at its fastest, in the tightest spaces. That was the challenge. Getting into the cave, getting through the water, and crossing the T junction.
Describe to me, if you can, what it's like to be a diver. Like, what's your visibility and what the experience is like?
In this circumstance, very quickly, visibility is zero. And visibility is so zero that the American military, when they came, had one experienced cave driver among them. And I interviewed him, and he said, when it's that dark, you don't even use the headlamp. The headlamp would be useless. You are blind, in effect, going through spaces in which there are stalactites, there are stalagmites, there are the craggy edges of the rocks that could potentially jab you, could potentially penetrate your suit or damage your equipment. So you are diving by braille through blackness and through a space that is constantly changing, because this is a space created by erosion. It's not created by us. So it might be incredibly narrow in one spot, and then a large chamber in another spot. So you're constantly having to work your way through different spaces that require different challenges. Rick Stanton was one of the two really crucial British divers, and I was very fortunate to get to interview him. And Rick said it was about 45% was completely flooded. So for 45% of the cave, you're swimming. And think of this. When I say swimming, most of us think of swimming on the surface. No, it's like swimming through a test tube filled completely with water. You're swimming through underwater. He said 45% you're kind of making your way through flooded areas, but you aren't necessarily swimming, and 10% you could walk. So it's if you have the slightest bit of claustrophobia, picture that. The other thing that happened is when you were going against the current, it was more difficult in the sense that you had to battle the strength of the water. Because again, remember, this isn't standing water. This is on an incline. You're in a cave system on a hill. So the water is coming against you. So there's that. But when you're going with the water, it means that any silt that you've kicked up with your fins, any debris that has gotten loose from the walls, if you're in a team of divers, anything that's been loosened by the diver ahead of you, all of that grit is coming against you. So it's not merely black. It's black and perilous in every way. So one thing that they realized, no individual diver could penetrate into the cave, cross the T junction, explore and find the boys. That was not going to happen. No one could carry enough oxygen. It was too dangerous. No team, no buddy team could do this. What they were going to have to do is map out where there were caverns that were above the water, and they would have to fill each cavern as a staging area with tanks, with gas, with food, with supplies, and anyone who attempted to rescue would have to go from staging area to staging area, and that would at least make it possible that one could go across the T-junction and see whether the boys were alive and where they were. This, of course, though, raises a second problem. if you're going to have staging areas, you have to get all the equipment to bring to the staging areas, and you have to have people to do it. Very soon, as word spread, this story sort of changed shape. So Thailand has been governed by a military dictatorship since 2014. The government is not popular. It also has a king, and the king is not popular. His father had been, but this king, for reasons no one quite knows, has been living most of the time in Munich. So much so that when his 13-year-old son wrote a letter to the boys, he wrote it in German. You have this distant king, you have this military dictatorship which sort of tries to control news, engages in fake news, engages in many things that perhaps might be familiar. So there was a public relations challenge and a public relations opportunity in the story of the boys in the cave. The challenge was, if this went badly, an unpopular government, which was talking about ultimately finally having elections, which they're actually slated to do this spring, it wouldn't play well for them if they bungled this. And yet, quickly, as the world became interested, it became important to the Thai government. Maybe it would have been anyway, but it became exponentially important. And so soon, reporters from around the world started flooding to the scene, government officials. And by sort of the central point of the boys being lost in the cave, there were 10,000 people at the cave mouth. Think of the analogy. Think of a disaster. Let's say somebody was in a car accident and was hurried off to the hospital. Would you want, you know, the press, family, soothsayers, everybody like that crowding in the operating room? No, you would want doctors to address the circumstance. It was absolute chaos. And this was something the Thai government couldn't really control. And to add to this, intelligently, local people first and then the government and others realized that, well, if the problem is that the caves are flooded, can we start to pump water out of the caves? Because if we can lower the water level, it'll be easier to get to the boys. So how are you going to lower the water level? Well, you can try to bring pumps into the cave and pumps tied to, you know, hoses, tubes that will bring water out. When they first tried it, it was a disaster. The equipment, most of it broke on the way. They couldn't manage it. Finally, they did manage to bring more pumps into the cave.
Large pumps are being used to drain the floodwaters, but divers working in shifts around the clock are restricted by their oxygen tanks, which only last 3 hours. An underwater robot has also been brought in, while the US and UK governments have sent experts with special equipment to assist.
Another option was, could they find, by scouring the hilltops, another entrance into the cave, another cavern that they could explore or even blast open that would lead them to the boys. And so now a whole other set of volunteers, my favorite actors here were in southern Thailand. There are a group of men that happen to be Muslim who are bird's nest collectors who collect certain bird's nests that are a delicacy in soup. And so they are very skilled at scouring hillsides and have very sharp eyes. Soon enough, the Japanese happened to have a satellite that could concentrate exactly on that area. And so they were, more and more people were involved in scouring the hillsides to try to see, is there another entrance into the cave? Then there's the third actor, which is the weather. If it had rained just that one day, you know, perhaps they could have waited a few days. But what was happening is that usually there's one monsoon at this time of year. This year, there was a second monsoon. So what they were actually doing was entering monsoon season, which meant that up to, and this happened actually 3 days in a row, 7 inches of rain are falling each day. Now, what's happening is not only are you're trying to pump out water, you're trying to get into the caves, you're trying to fill the caverns, you're trying to get to the T-junction, but you're dealing with more and more and more water. There was a ticking clock as to, if they're alive at all, how long could they be alive, and therefore what steps needed to be taken. The Thai government made two very good decisions, that they realized this 10,000 people at the cave mouth, which by now included, and to speak of volunteerism, Thai people came there to wash the clothes of all the rescuers, because each day their clothes were getting filthy. They came to cook for the rescuers, and because they realized early on that the rescuers were of different backgrounds, they had people cooking halal Muslim dishes and cooking for people with Hindu or Buddhist or Western. They're cooking. All this is for free, just being made. Even people came to give haircuts. So the Thai government realized they needed all of this to be structured. And they called on the American military, with whom they have close relations. And so a team of 35 American military search and rescue experts came. Their responsibility was to kind of organize everything that was going on. There were two groups of Chinese volunteers who are kind of international rescue experts. And then there were individual groups from literally all over the world. And most of those volunteers were cave divers, because it became clear that the skill set that would matter was cave diving. But at a certain point, they realized that given the difficulty of the cave, they needed the world's very best, Rick Stanton and John Volanthin, who are both from the United Kingdom.
Out of their wetsuits, 47-year-old John is an IT consultant, 57-year-old Rick, a retired firefighter. But both are known around the world for their self-taught hobby, considered among the best cave divers on the planet, nicknamed the A-Team. It's a skill John once compared to space travel.
When people landed on the moon, they had a map. They knew where they were going. But in a cave, if you're beyond the known limit of the cave, nobody knows where it goes. You never know what will happen around the corner.
Meanwhile, let's talk about the kids in the cave, what's happening there with Eck and the kids.
They're on a sandy bank with no food, and it's pitch dark except for the occasional moment where they use a flashlight. And they're all scared because the main thing on their minds in terms of fears is that they hadn't told their parents, and that their parents are now going to understand what happened. So they're getting, in effect, caught in the lie. But Eck, who was himself stateless and had lost his family at an early age, had for 10 years lived in a Buddhist monastery, and he was very skilled at meditation. And so he taught the boys to meditate. They learned to watch their thoughts, not to pretend they weren't having their thoughts, not to deny their thoughts. And the benefit of this was that instead of just gave them a chore to try to scrape at the rock to see if they could kind of build a channel, he gave them a purpose and a rotation. You would work until you were tired, and then the next team of boys would take your place. So they had a purpose. They had a way to calm their thoughts. They had a kind of social organization, which is to say the older boys began to take care of the younger boys. And you can get a sense of how this is working in that they stopped speaking to Eck as coach, and they started to call him brother. They were becoming a family. There is, at least in how the boys have talked about it, there was a degree of trust in adults that I'm not sure you would equally feel here. And there is one thing that was mentioned once by one of the boys, actually when he was in New York, which is at one point they heard a whistle. Not a whistle like whistle a happy tune, but like the whistle of equipment. And that told them that people were looking for them. And I will say, you know, I had done a prior book called Trapped about the 33 men who were trapped in the mine in Chile. And they did very similar things. And I should mention here, cave divers have a motto or a rule: don't panic. Because if you only have so much air, if you panic, you start gulping air. But because you're in such extreme conditions, you have to keep your calm and keep your mind clear. And in a way, that's what the boys were doing under X guidance. But then two things happened, and one of which Rick Stanton told me, which he had never told anyone else. And I was so thrilled to hear from him a story that had never made the press. When they went in, this was during these days of seven-inch rain, where it was really, really bad. And these world's best cave divers made it to chamber three. Chamber three is where was a large chamber where the pumping equipment was and where the staging area where they were really starting to put gas and other materiel. And when they got to chamber three, they discovered four men from a pumping crew who'd been left there, and there was no way out. You could no longer get out of chamber three by walking. So here you have four men who are not divers, who have no experience, who now we have four more people trapped in the cave. And what Rick and John decided to do is that they would dive them out. They would go in relays where they would basically stick the gas mouthpiece in their mouth. These guys have no idea. They can't speak to each other. They can't communicate. They don't know what's going on. You're going underwater, so you are very likely to panic. But Rick and John, one by one, dove them out. And this had two opposite effects on them. On the one hand, if you wanted a perfect image of the chaos of the rescue, this was it. So that was kind of a sign of how bad it was. But for the first time, it hinted to them there might be a way to bring people out of a cave who aren't cave divers.
So the rains finally stop, and the divers are able to get past this T junction, just barely. I'd like you to read from your book what happens at this point.
Every so often, they would emerge from the water and sniff, because there had been no smell of humans anywhere. And Rick popped out of the water, took off his headgear and sniffed, and he was in an outhouse. He was smelling the most intense smell of human beings. And he knew that they were going to find out right then what had happened. But they very seriously thought the boys might have all drowned, been killed. So this is how I write it. So Valentin swam closer, the camera on his helmet filming. Stanton was scanning the steep sandy slope and keeping a tally of the boys. One by one, the boys and Eck were rounding a bend out of the darkness and edging down the thin wedge of slope towards the light. They're all alive, Stanton exclaimed.
How many of you? 13? Brilliant. We are coming. It's okay.
It's okay.
Many people are coming.
Many, many people.
We are the first. Many people come.
What's one day? So all 13 were there, which nobody expected. Stanton and Valentin had found them.
All right, enormous relief in Thailand as rescue teams found that youth soccer team. Look at that, alive in a cave nearly 10 days after the group went missing. This rescue mission, though, is far from over. They still must find a way to get the kids and their coach out from underground.
They realized what a huge challenge this was, because while people have been rescued from caves in the past, the people who've been rescued were cave divers, because no one else is deep in a flooded cave. Now they were going to have to figure out a rescue for 12 boys and a 25-year-old, none of whom had ever dived.
So why did they, how did they come to this decision to sedate the, I understand why. They had to because the kids would panic.
They're, right.
How long was the journey from the sand where they were to the exit?
Right. The actual journey, I believe, was about 2.5 hours for the kids. Well, it was 9 hours there and back, but there were breaks. And the thing was that they realized they had to sedate the kids because they would panic, back to the thing about don't panic. So what happened is there were these two very good Australian cave divers, one of whom happened to be a doctor who deals in anesthetics, so anesthesiologist. So he swam out to the boys and talked to them about doing this and got their each of them individually to agree to this. And also the Thai government had to agree to it because, again, think in American terms, liability. But the Thai government agreed and each individual agreed.
So was there a precedent? Had that, had anybody ever be rescued?
Not that I'm aware of. This was absolutely unprecedented. But they didn't know the dosage correctly. So on the very first boy who was brought out, three times as they were bringing out, he started to wake up. So the diver who, just think about this. I talked about being in pitch dark with all these hazards around you. Now you're carrying a boy like a satchel who starts to wake up and he can't wake up. So what you have to do now is find your syringe, find the needle, put in the dosage, readminister the anesthetic, put the boy back to sleep, put your needles in their case, put your syringe away, and keep swimming. That happened three times in the first, as they brought the first boy out.
So they figured out the proper dosage after that.
Yeah, they figured out that did not happen again. They didn't initially announce the sedation, but they ultimately did. They even mentioned how they did it.
Did they inject the kids or was it in the gas?
I believe they injected. Certainly, I know he injected in the case of the kid who was waking up, they injected him. So I believe that is what they did.
And now the story of, wow, probably almost the year at this point. Breaking news, all 12 boys and their soccer coach have now been finally rescued from deep inside that cave in Thailand.
Such great news. The last few people were pulled out just this morning after being trapped for more than 2 weeks. CBS 2's Cara Finstrom is here live with those breaking news.
All right, so spoiler alert, everybody gets out. It's amazing. It's an amazing story. They become international heroes. One sort of strange story that came out with this was, and you didn't talk about it that much in the book, but was the Elon Musk incident.
Okay, so in order to get the kids out of the cave, they would have to wear wetsuits. The way they were going to get the gas was not through a mouthpiece, but they were going to, the gas was going to come through a face mask. So the gas was attached to the face mask. So this way we didn't have to worry about keeping the mouthpiece in the kid's mouth. They're just breathing through the face mask. And so in order to try this out, local Thai middle school kids volunteered, came to a swimming pool, and they tried out different sized equipment to try to match what would work for the kids in the cave. That was kind of a wonderful thing the middle school kids did. They kept worrying about finding a face mask that would seal on the faces of the smallest boys because the face masks they happened to have available were adult face masks. And so Musk volunteered this, that he and his engineers who, you know, build spacecraft and they build Teslas and they, you know, are really good at building things and they have, you know, infinite budgets, would build a mini submarine, which would allow them to bring out the smallest kids. And Musk, according to reports, actually got as far as Chamber 3 himself. I'm eager to hear more about that because that was no easy thing, and I'm surprised to hear that, but it reportedly he did. And they actually did bring and get the submarine done in time. By the time they got it there, 2/3 of the kids were already out, and the team felt better about continuing to use the techniques they had already developed rather than making use of this submarine, which people weren't entirely sure could negotiate the spaces. For all that, Musk certainly is a guy who's interested in public relations. He's offered to give water to the kids who've been poisoned in Flint, et cetera. You know, he looks for ways to create a splash. There was a particular need that he set out to address, but it wound up being that they chose not to make use of what he offered. And so we can't really say how much it could have worked or could not have worked. Where the story took a very bad turn is that after it all was over, and this British guy who had actually led to bringing Rick and John over and was very important in the rescue, sort of said that the submarine never would have worked. He was pretty critical of it. And Musk responded with really kind of horrible homophobic insults directed towards the British guy. And so really something that had elements of, you know, for all that it may have had PR qualities, actually was attuned to the nature of the challenge, took a very bad turn.
So let's talk about the process of writing this book.
Right.
So you get this assignment, you're hiking with your kids, right, when the call comes from...
Right. I was up in the Alps with my wife and kids when I got enough internet to see the email from a publisher that asked me, could I do an instant book, quick book on this? And I said, yes, I had followed. And the thing that really made me want to do it, and I want to go back to this whole point about statelessness and Abdul. So Abdul, who's the one who spoke English, it's not Abdul, it's Abdul, A-D-U-L. Abdul is stateless, but Abdul is 14 and speaks five languages. And he is the perfect image of the immigrant, endangered immigrant child, the person who puts everything into studying, into improving himself, into becoming the best person he could possibly be. He wants to be a soccer star, okay, he's 14. But there was something, and I read about this, and there was something glorious about the fact that it was the stateless child who was able to speak to the rescuers. And indeed, that this was internationalism at its very best, and that the divers, the rescuers, felt it. They felt that this was the world doing what the world must do. So to be given the chance to write about this at the moment that our nation was separating parents and children at our borders, to write about this epitome of the spirit of the international, epitome of the value of the undocumented, the stateless people of this world, the refugees of this world, really felt important to me. But because internationalism was so important, it was absolutely crucial to me to get the story from as many angles as I possibly could. And so what I did is I immediately hired two doctoral students. I teach in the Rutgers Graduate School in the School of Communication and Information. And so I hired two doctoral students to help me gather information. And then I hired three Thai students or recent graduates from Princeton to scour Thai media and Thai social networks. I worked with a professor at the Princeton Library who's Chinese to scour the Chinese media sources and social networks. And I hired a colleague who reads Japanese to scour the Japanese sources. So what I was doing is I was looking to get this story from as many voices and as many angles and as many perspectives as I could, so that the internationalism of the book would match the internationalism of the experience. And it was marvelous how the story changed. The Chinese version of the story and the experiences of the Chinese team was fascinating.
Well, how was it different? What were some of the different perspectives that surprised you?
Well, one that really I loved, and I found this on Thai television. So when they started pumping these huge mammoth sheets of water out of the cave, is going to go somewhere. And where it happened to go was on the fields of rice farmers. So there was an interview with a woman who was a rice farmer. And so the question is, they asked, well, how do you feel? You've lost your crops. You know, are you mad? Are you going to sue the government? You know, and she said, look, rice can be replanted. If they don't get the water out of the cave, the boys will die. And so then the government offered to repay her for her crop and to give her new rice to for the next planting. And she said, I felt sorry for the government. They were spending so much money on the rescue. I didn't want their money. And that was just so culturally fascinating.
Yeah. That is fascinating.
And I will say one thing that was interesting to me as an American, because of the volunteer army, I at least live in a world where I have very close to zero contact with the military. And we just hear about it in, you know, wherever it is, Iraq, Afghanistan, some kind of engagement. But it was really quite fascinating to learn how, as an exercise in management, they are really skilled at handling crises under difficult conditions. And Major Hodges was fascinating. The first day after they got the first four out, he called almost like a crisis meeting because he felt the danger of complacency. He thought that in some ways success was their enemy and that they had to look for what they weren't seeing. And I thought that was just such good management.
Is this for middle-aged kids? Like, what is the target?
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of my books are this way. I want to make it accessible for middle grade through high school kids.
Thank you.
But, you know, traditionally, the New York Times was always said to be written on an eighth grade level. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot in the book that I think adults don't know. And so I've tried to respect, you know, the curiosity. You know, I just realized this. I try to respect the curiosity and the intelligence of my reader. So respecting the curiosity of my reader means that I have to be able to answer your questions. If you don't know where Northern Thailand is, I got to tell you. If you're not familiar with Buddhist ideas about reincarnation, I've got to fill you in. So I respect your curiosity, but I also don't feel a need to dumb it down. I do think that you can understand how the press is controlled under a military dictatorship. That's something you can think about, you know, as a young person, just as we think about it as adults. So that's what I try to do, is find that balance where no reader, my younger readers feel invited, don't feel left out of. And that's, I guess, the crucial thing I want to say. And a number of writers are doing this now, both in fiction and nonfiction, feeling that we can bring the present to young people. Mm-hmm. This is true in a lot of YA novels now that are dealing with Black Lives Matter and issues like that, that being young, you are not separate from the world. There are streams of information all around you, whether it's rumor or social networking or what you hear in school or what's on the media. And books for young people can engage with the present.
So for people who want to write for this audience, I love this idea, you know, don't dumb it down. You know, I would imagine a lot of people who think when they're writing for kids, they have to write in sort of like kid language,
right,
and not use big words and
right,
not maybe tackle.
I couldn't disagree more.
What advice do you give to people who want to write for that audience?
Yeah, the first advice I give to all writers is read a lot. You know, there are a lot of people who do this very well. So the American Library Association gives out two prizes for excellence in nonfiction. So one is for readers through age 14. It's called the Seibert. So the first thing I would say, if you want to write for this age, look who's won or been an honor in the Seibert in recent years and read a couple of their books. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there's an author named Steve Schenken, and what he's really pioneered in doing for this age is to write narrative nonfiction. You know, the famous phrase reads like a novel. It doesn't mean he's invented anything. It doesn't mean it's fictionalized dialogue. No, but he's really great at creating that kind of cliffhanger effect that makes you propelled forward through the book. So that's one kind of nonfiction for this younger age group. The other thing about writing in middle grade that this is something I pay a lot of attention to, and an author named Susan Campbell Bartoletti and another Tanya Lee Stone. What we pay a lot of attention to is how text works with images. In adult nonfiction, if there are images at all, they're generally gathered in an insert. But in a great deal of nonfiction for middle grade and even young adult, just as in picture books for children, art and text are in a dance, are in a dialogue. And that can be a very rich reading experience where, on the one hand, and this is kind of a cheat, if you're a kid who doesn't want to put in a lot of time, you can read the captions and get a sense of the book just by going through it that way. But on the other hand, there is a, so the last, my wife and I have written two books together. One's called Sugar Changed the World, and the other one is called Eyes of the World, which was about two photographers, a couple, Robert Capa and Gerda Taro. And we really tried to write that book as both a text and photo essay. So text and photo were continually working together, as they did for Capa and Taro. And so that's a particular skill and thinking that goes there. But I think the other thing to think about, I would say, to me, the key in communicating to middle grade readers or young adult readers is your own passion. The point is, you're writing about this because you care about it, not because it's an assignment, you know, read these four pages and answer these seven questions. You're writing about because something about this story, this event, this person, this experience, you really feel is important that you want to share with your younger reader. And I think that eagerness to communicate does come across in the page. I think for me, what I often want young people to come away with is ideas. I want a young person to enjoy the adventure and drama of what happened in Thailand, but I want them to think about internationalism. I want them to think about a world in which we help each other. The image that came to me at the very end was just after the boys were rescued, the scientists announced that they had discovered water under the surface of Mars. And it struck me that the very same qualities that allowed us to succeed in Thailand, the international cooperation, the meditation and clear thinking, the kind of ability not to panic and to figure out the best plans under all circumstances are what's going to take us to Mars. How we behaved collectively as the world together in Thailand was truly inspiring.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Right About Now, hosted by my dad, Jonathan Small. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to his podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may find podcasts. Or you can go to his website, rightaboutnowmedia.com. And listen there. This is Ella reminding you to
do the right thing.